You're listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast, a product of the Oregon Basketball Coaches Association. To learn more, visit our website at or.nhsbca.org. Welcome to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. I'm Derek Duman, OBCA President and Boys Basketball Coach at West Albany High School. Today, I'm joined by Jim Sollers, retired women's basketball coach from the University of Portland. Coach, how are you doing today?
Good, thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I'm excited to talk some basketball with you. For people that maybe aren't familiar with you, Coach, can you tell us a little bit about your basketball and coaching journey, how you got into coaching, and then how you ended up as the head women's coach at the University of Portland?
Well, I went to college. I played basketball in high school and in junior college, and went to undergraduate and graduate school to be a history professor. I was at the University of Washington, and while I was writing my dissertation my last 2 years there, they hired me to teach full-time as an acting instructor, the low man on the totem pole. But I was lecturing to 600 students at a time, and certainly wasn't what I wanted to do. So when I finished my PhD, there were very, very few jobs in the United States at that time, particularly in my field. And so I was offered a job at the Bush School in Seattle, teaching history, German, coaching boys basketball and rugby. And so I coached boys basketball there for 3 years, was hired then at Wenatchee Valley College in Wenatchee, Washington, to teach history, head of the history department, and coach women's basketball. I'd never done that before, so it was quite a new experience. And that was 1976, so women's competitive basketball on the collegiate level was very different in those days. Went from there in 1983 to Portland State University, coached there for 3 years, and then I was at the University of Portland from 86 until 2014.
Awesome. Coach, I do want to ask you a little bit about, you know, coaching women's basketball in 1976. I mean, as you mentioned, that was a very interesting time for competitive women's athletics, obviously Title IX being passed a few years earlier. What was that experience like for you, and what kind of do you remember about taking over a women's program in the Title IX era?
Well, you know, the interesting thing was Wenatchee Valley College was way ahead of the game. Had an athletic director, been an old cigar-smoking former wrestling coach, but they hadn't won many championships, and he thought women's basketball would be the way to do it. And so he, in 77 actually, when he offered the scholarships to me, so he'd give me 10 tuition scholarships and 10 jobs for room and board. And Wenatchee, only one of the few community colleges in the states with dormitories. And so we just, frankly, out-recruited everybody. We had more money than anybody, including Washington and Washington State. I had 10 scholarships, and I think Washington had 3. Washington State had 2 at the time. So it was very different, although, you know, in those days we jammed the whole team in one van, and we had sack lunches, and, you know, very different, different budgetary issues.
For sure.
And so that was, you know, that was my introduction into it. But as time went on, of course, all that changed, and changed pretty rapidly. It took, although Title IX had been enacted, it certainly hadn't been enforced many places at all.
Right. Yeah. How about the jump from junior college, Wenatchee Valley, to Division I at Portland State? What was that jump like for you, and how was that maybe different, the two levels?
Well, it was, you know, we had one of the best junior college teams in the country. And going from that to Portland State, which had really struggled, that was quite an adjustment, just dealing with losing more games than I'd been accustomed to. But I had a good group of kids, and they competed hard, and Portland State was a great place in terms of faculty support. I had great friends in the athletic department, other coaches, administrators, and I really enjoyed my 3 years there. Their facility was marginal at best at that time. They didn't have men's basketball during those years. And so basketball is not a big emphasis, no question about that.
Yeah.
So the adjustment, you know, obviously bigger, better players, and the competition was much, much more difficult than I'd been used to, no question.
Yeah. And then you ended up at UP for the rest of your career and had quite a bit of success, including 4 consecutive NCAA tournament appearances in the 90s. What kept you at UP for so long, and especially with, you know, what we think of as, like, college coaching is difficult because, you know, you feel like you have a job one day and then you don't another day, right? So what do you think kept you at UP for so long, and how did you sustain that success?
You know, when I first went to work there, for the first 12 years I was there, I taught in the history department 1/3 time and coached full time. But one of the things that kept me there was it was a great, great environment for families. My 2 youngest children were just growing up in that gym, and my wife got her master's degree there. 3 of my 4 kids ended up going to school there, so it was a great family environment. Beautiful place to work. Loved the athletic department. My coaching friends were my best friends. We had a great social relationship among the coaches and the athletic administrative staff. So it was just a very, very good working environment.
Yeah. What do you think led to your sustained success at University of Portland? What was it that you did, you think, specifically, or that your coaches did that helped build, like, a consistent WCC title contender?
Well, I think, first of all, we had a good product. The University of Portland had really good academic reputation, had good academic support from the very beginning. We had one of the nicer, at that time, facilities in the conference. And I was fortunate to have many great assistant coaches. So you get consistency when that happens.
Yeah, no kidding. How did your coaching philosophy change from when you started? So at the, I think it was at the high school you mentioned, where you were coaching rugby and boys basketball, to when your career ended in 2014, I think you said. How did kind of your style and philosophy change over that time?
Well, you know, when I first started, I'd been used to playing fast break high school basketball, fast break junior college basketball. So that was my philosophy. And I thought, well, that's the system we'd have to use. And frankly, when I was at Wenatchee Valley College, we had such a jump on people in terms of scholarships and benefits that we could recruit the athletes that fit our style. I mean, I had much greater pick of players than I would later. As time went on, scholarships were added to most schools that we competed against. And so at that point in time, you're really working hard to get the best players you possibly could, but they couldn't always fit into that system you'd preordained. So had to adjust, I think, with time, and certainly in the last 15 years, had to adjust the system to some degree, depending on the quality players that we got. So I think had to be much more flexible in terms of saying, okay, this group of kids just cannot press, or this group of kids really don't do a very good job man-to-man defense or player-to-player. So we're going to have to figure out another way of skinning that cat. And so I think that became, you know, I often think of the job my last few years a lot like small town high school coaches who get a whole different kind of player from year to year, and so they can't just go with one system. They have to adjust to what comes through the door.
Yeah, and finding ways to have success with all those teams, right, is oftentimes what makes those coaches so good.
Right, I think that's true, and I think some of the small high school coaches and that I've been around in the states of Washington and Oregon are the best coaches, because they, one year they might have a great, big, powerful center. The next year, you know, have a team of midgets. You know, you just don't know.
Yeah, exactly. What's something you wish you had learned earlier in your career? Something maybe you would go back and tell yourself as a young, spry coach after your 30-plus years in the business. What would you go back and tell yourself?
You know, I think I would say that getting players who can either adjust to your system or you adjust to their talents. It wasn't a matter of the system wasn't going to beat anyone. It was whether or not the kids could execute that system. And so having to balance those two things, I wish I'd learned earlier.
Mm-hmm. The Jimmys and Joes beats X's and O's, right? That's that kind of old philosophy.
Yeah. It's an old adage, but I think it's true.
Yeah. So as high school coaches, we're getting ready to kind of reestablish some of our cultures and values coming out of the pandemic. You know, we had a shortened season in the spring and we're getting ready to start up this next week. You had a lot of experience with that in terms of recruiting and bringing new players into your program, right? And so what kind of advice do you have, or what were some things you did to teach the new players about your culture, about your values, to get them ready to go to be a basketball player for you?
Well, one of the things we did was we tried to discourage kids from wearing their old high school sweatshirts. We tried to get them to wear UP stuff or Portland State stuff. Wear the equipment that we hand you. Secondly, at the University of Portland, and I got this from Butler University, teaching the new kids, all the players had to be able to sing the school song. And after every victory, that was one of the things we did. But we would test them at the end of the first week, and they all had to be able, as a group, to sing the school song. So we tried to get them thinking in terms of being not Beavers, not whatever their previous school mascot had been, but they were now Pilots, and getting to think in those terms. And I think the next thing was we really tried to clarify team work expectations, attitude expectations, and academic expectations, and let them know that we're going to hold them accountable for it. We're going to hold them accountable for hard work and good attitude in practice. We're going to hold them accountable for class attendance, and if they couldn't adjust to that, then they were going to have to suffer consequences.
Yeah. Did you have some help probably from your, I would hope that, you know, once you got the program going, your upperclassmen would help with that as well, I would assume.
Oh, yeah. You know, you rely on very heavily. And one of the things that I also learned early on is the more rules you make, the more rules you have to enforce. So it's best to keep them very simple and very clear. And one of the things that we told our seniors and our freshmen, or newcomers, but primarily freshmen, we didn't have all that many transfers, is that we expected the older kids to make sure the younger players weren't having difficulty, especially socially. They weren't partying to excess. They were going to class. And we tried to impress upon the older kids that it wasn't a matter, they weren't squealing on their younger teammates. It's a part of the expectation. You're doing them a favor if you let us intervene if they're having difficulties. And so our seniors, upperclassmen, took real, real leadership roles in helping to sort of enforce the norms we would like to see. We didn't expect kids to be Puritans. They were college kids. They were away from home for the first time. But we did expect them to accept and live by the general norms of performance that we ask of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Coach, I'm curious, you know, you've recruited hundreds, maybe thousands of different athletes over your college coaching career. What are some things maybe you think high school coaches could do a better job of to get their kids ready for the college basketball level?
Well, you know, I think one of the things, obviously, it's critical is that they have high academic standards. If the kids don't get the grades, they're not going to be playing somewhere else. And hold them accountable to that. Whether it be, and certainly the star players, if they expect to go on, they have to go to class, they have to perform well, they have to have some discipline within the classroom. Secondly, I think is to expect hard work from your best player. It's harder work, if not harder work in practice than from the last person on the bench. Thirdly, I think attitude. When I'd go to games, watch kids play, and this particularly in the summer, but if there was a player, particularly the better players, who were harping on their teammates to get them the ball, nagging at them, rolling their eyeballs at every foul that was called against them, berating their teammates if they didn't catch a pass, that was a sure sign that's somebody that's not going to be fun to coach. And I think, holding kids accountable academically for hard work, and for attitude, I think is really important, particularly the better players. Sometimes they assume they don't need to abide by those same rules. And they, if anything, we need to enforce them to a greater degree than we do almost anyway.
Yeah.
If you're talking about skill, what they can prepare, I would say, athleticism is a genetic thing, so there's not much you can do about that. But I think if there's one single skill that I think kids need to really focus on in high school and coaches need to really work at improving their skills on, that's shooting. By the time a kid gets to be 17 years of age, junior or senior in high school, probably not going to change their muscle memory habits as far as shooting. If they don't shoot the ball well at that age, they're probably not going to shoot the ball well later. We may be able to maybe improve their defensive technique, their blockout techniques, a number of things, but I don't think after the age of 17, in rare cases, do we make a poor shooter a good shooter. We might make a great shooter out of a good one with hard work, but I'm not sure you can take one that doesn't shoot the ball well and make them a good shooter at that age.
Yeah. I would assume, Coach, too, you know, when you're recruiting at the college level, the girls you're getting were probably the best players on their team, right? So there's probably a little bit of a expectation readjustment that they have to make going from the best player on their high school team to, you know, maybe an eighth, ninth, tenth girl on the college team.
Right.
How did you go about handling those situations? Or do you have a story or some things that you maybe focused on to do that?
Well, I think we had to talk with them all the time because all of a sudden, you know, during the preseason scrimmages, they have an open gym. Suddenly they can't hit lay-ins. They can't hit a foul shot, which they, you know, things that they've always been able to do because of the intimidation, the increased competition, just the additional pressure. I think a lot of kids think they have to play faster when they get to college, and as a result, they don't play as well. And so I think it takes, you know, working on them in drills, working with them individually, and also bringing them in and talking to them and say, listen, you know, for the first 6 months, you're going to struggle. It's just the way it is. You're playing against players who are older, who are also the stars of their teams. And you need to work as hard as you possibly can, but recognize you're not going to get the shot off every time if you're inside 15 feet. So figuring out, helping them with their role, what they can do to make themselves better, what they can do to increase their playing time, I think those are all really important points. Once in a while, you'll get a freshman that comes in that's just, you know, great from – adjusts to it without any problem at all, but that's pretty rare.
Right. That's a good signing if you got that kid coming in, right? Because you got a good recruiting class.
Right.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll return with more from Coach Sollers right after this on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
Coaches, as you prepare for the upcoming season, don't forget to renew your OBCA membership. Membership includes access to exclusive resources from high school coaches across the country, as well as access to Lucio Sports Technology, the same technology used by NBA franchises. Membership starts at just $15. Don't delay. Renew your OBCA membership today.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Derek Duman here with Coach Jim Sollers. Coach, my next question is about practice, and I actually got to watch your team's practice a little bit, but not everybody has. So my question is, what did you do in preparation for practice? What did your practices look like, and how did you know if your team had a good practice?
Well, I think to start with, we always met with the staff prior to practice, talked about what we needed to work on, how much time we wanted to devote to it, who was going to be teaching a particular drill before we ever got on the floor. Then we posted the schedule of practice in the locker room so they could see what we were going to do, so there were no guesses. We were sometimes had to be a little bit flexible, but they generally had an idea of what to expect when they came on the practice floor. Then I think hopefully what we had were energetic, hardworking practices. Wasn't always that way, but that's what we hoped for. And I think one of the things we tried to do was not to let practice drag. We had a schedule, and we tried to, if we had to continue with a segment because it just wasn't getting done, we did that. But a lot of the time, we kept a pretty rigorous schedule, and so that it moved along. Players knew what to do. We went from one drill to the next. Not a lot of standing around. Hopefully not a lot of people on the sideline. Rarely wanted to have people just standing there watching someone else. So we tried to have as many people involved in every drill as we possibly could. And I think that helped the hours go by. We didn't have three-hour practices. We tried to get in and out in 2 to 2.5 hours because we had our academic requirements were high, and we knew their time was limited. Also, I'm not sure after the 2.5 hour period, I'm not sure how much was retained anyway. They're just looking forward to the end of practice. Try to keep them short. And I had a friend who coached at the Air Force Academy where they just came in. They had 2 hours. Come in, get dressed, get takes, get on the floor, practice, get out, all in 2 hours. And I think and they did a nice job. They were forced to pay attention, and they kept that attention finely honed, and I think that's the way to go in a practice. I think 4 hour practices may have been the traditional way of doing it. I don't think it's a smart way to go in this day and age.
Yeah. Was there anything you tried to work on every practice, you know, whether it be a specific skill or anything like that, or did it vary?
You know, we always tried to get at least 20 minutes of shooting of one type or another, either contested shooting or individual shooting, partner shooting, whatever. We tried to make sure we got at least 20 minutes of shooting in per day. And I think as a result, our kids shot the ball pretty well, generally speaking.
We
had to do the defense, the rebounding, that kind of thing. But shooting was the constant that we had.
Yeah. I want to go back to, you talked about posting your practice for kids to see. It seems like there's kind of like two philosophies behind that in coaching. Some coaches want to keep everything under wraps, close to the chest. You know, I don't want the kids to know what we're doing, so they're not slacking off on certain drills, for example. And then others who are like you, who like to give it to them so they know what to expect and can do it efficiently. I'm just curious, maybe, like, why did you choose to show them the practice plan beforehand?
In my my wife, Pam, was an elementary school teacher for 35 years, and I learned from her early on that kids like routine. They like to know what's going on, what's going to happen. They're more comfortable with that. And I think it applies to basketball as well. It applies to older kids. I think they like to – it doesn't mean you can't change it up and do some other things once in a while, but I think they like to know what they are going to be facing that day and what the expectations are.
Yeah. I love it. So go back to the very first time they're learning, right? Don't sweet. Keep it simple.
Keep it simple, stupid. We'll just say keep it simple.
That's right.
The old KISS philosophy.
That's right. What do you think was the best thing you did as a coach? What was kind of your strength?
You know, I think I was pretty good at relating to the student athlete in both basketball, academics, and their social life. I tried to know what they were facing, what they were dealing with, and get them comfortable with talking with me about things other than just basketball, what's happening on the floor. I think our university was really conducive to that. I think the kids went to the University of Portland. A lot of kids went to the University of Portland because it was a small school environment, yet, you know, Division I athletics. And I think they wanted to feel like they were important individually. And I think I probably did as good a job with that as anything else.
Yeah, that's awesome. Coach, you talked a little bit about assistance and pre-practice and figuring out who's going to do what. I mean, you've gotten to mentor some pretty successful coaches that were once assistants under you, probably most notably in the state of Oregon now. Kelly Graves was once an assistant at the University of Portland, but many, many more. How did you go about intentionally developing your assistant coaches?
You know, that's really one of the most difficult problems a head coach has, is trying to give them enough responsibility so they feel useful, give them enough teaching responsibility so they learn to do that, but also demanding that they do the dirty work, the recruiting, which nobody necessarily likes. And I think that it's always a sort of, you had to evaluate the amount of experience they had had, how well they related to kids, how well they taught. Some very bright assistant coaches were just not good at teaching a skill. And so you kind of had to weigh those factors and hopefully keep them happy by giving them enough what they would consider significant responsibilities, yet not pushing them into situations that they couldn't handle. Our first job was to give the best instruction possible to our players, so it was unfair to put someone who is very uncomfortable teaching a group too many responsibilities in terms of drills and what have you. But I think it's always an individual thing. Evaluating the assistant. Now, with somebody like Kelly Graves, he had a great feel for every part of the game, from recruiting, and he was a fanatically good recruiter, still is. He had a great feel for the game. Personality that appealed to the kids, was able to teach. I had many others who had many of those same traits. And so you just had to evaluate individual basis. I don't think there's any hard and fast rule. But we tried to give everybody some teaching responsibilities depending on their skill level. Everybody had to pitch in the recruiting because that's a big part of what the college thing is about. So we all did the dirty work, and some assistants got to do more teaching than others. It was just the way it was.
How about hiring assistants? So when going through the process, you know, obviously at the college levels might be a little different than the high school level, but in an interview or in conversations with potential assistant coaches, what were some things you were looking for?
Well, a lot of times I hired them by watching them perform either for other teams as head coaches or as assistant coaches to get a feel for how they related to players, personality in general. Can they relate to players? Could they go into a home and be comfortable talking with parents and young kids? Were they enthusiastic about coach? How was their enthusiasm level? Were they really enthusiastic about being a college coach, or did they just not have anything else that they wanted to do at the time? And so I think all of those things entered into it. And I got very lucky. I hired some assistant coaches came from having coached in our basketball camp. So I got a chance to watch them interact with the kids and their teaching methods. Kelly Graves, you talked about him. He was a women's coach at Big Bend Community College, and they'd been a horrible program, hadn't had a win forever. And then 2 years after he'd been there for 2 years, I watched him play against Clark College over in Vancouver, and they were incredibly well coached, very good team. And I thought, you know, this guy's got something going for him. And so ended up talking with him and hired him. But I think a lot of my assistants were young men and women who had worked our camps. So I got to know them pretty well from that angle.
Yeah, that's awesome. Was there any role or responsibility that you took care of yourself? So, you know, in delegating stuff to your assistants, was there anything that you would say, nope, this is mine, I'm teaching this or I'm running this, because you felt really passionate about it?
You know, I'm not sure that's true with regard to on-court skills things, but there were some things that I, because I had a foot in each camp, I dealt with a lot of the academic stuff. We always had academic advice, but the coaches need to deal with that. And so I handled the difficult academic situations most of the time. And I think that was a part of, I think since I was on the faculty as well as coaching, I think I was best suited to do that kind of thing. I knew what the expectations were. As far as practice, I enjoyed fast break drills. So I probably did more of that than some other things. In my later years, I did a lot more of the defensive stuff than I did early on. So I would say, yeah, at the end, my last few years there, I did a lot more with the defense than I had previously.
Okay. Coach, you know that building a cohesive team is really important to having success and winning championships. What did you do, or how did you go about building cohesive teams that played together and doing so with kids that came from all over the country?
Well, you know, I think a part of it was just building relationships through chatting with kids, as a group and individually. We in the fall before practice actually started, we do ropes courses. We give the team leaders, the older kids, certain responsibilities so that they bought into the program what we wanted, and they in some ways could communicate to the younger players better than we could. One of the things that I didn't have to deal with for as long as all the young coaches today have to deal with is the telephone situation. It seems silly, but we really limited the time that kids could be on their phones when we were traveling or even in town, with the telephones. We made them talk to each other. For instance, there were no telephones during pregame meals. Just as one. When they were in their room after all of our daily activities, for example, if we were on the road, no telephones during the day. They could get on their telephones after they went to bed or went to their rooms after, usually we have an evening practice, for example, or after the game. But we really tried to limit the telephone thing. It was, very frustrating for me trying to talk to someone who had their nose in a phone and working their fingers. I Yeah, that was extremely difficult, and I'm sure coaches today can relate to that more than I did.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Coach, I'm curious, you know, history professor, doctorate, even. Do you have any good pregame talks or pregame stories that you would use that we as coaches could maybe put in our back pocket for this coming season?
No, probably not. Just trying to get kids, to do their job, to not worry about the scoreboard as much as just the process. If you worked hard, you know, if we as coaches could get our kids to sprint the floor every time, if we could get them to bend their knees every time on defense, if we could get them to talk even, all things they could do, we'd have great teams. We can't all do that. We can't get our players to do that. I'd mainly talk about the process, here are the things we're going to do. We're going to try to limit the number of easy shots we miss. Focus on the rim. Don't take risky passes. Make sure you know who you're passing the ball to, and preferably a teammate, not the opponent. Box out. Everybody can box out. If you're 5'2", if you're 6'9", you can box out. You can go for the rebound. Trying to tell them, here are the things that every one of you can do. Let's just go do them. And if we do those things as a team, we'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious a little bit about how it maybe changed, but also, I mean, analytics have become a really huge part of the game. I think they were starting to be a big part as you kind of ended your career. Are there any specific statistics or things that you would look at, whether it be at halftime or after the game, that gave you insight onto how your team played?
Well, I think statistics are really important. I think if you look at it, if you have certain goals in terms of shooting percentages, if your team's shooting 33%, you're taking bad shots or you're just bad shooters, one of the two. And so, you know, you need to reevaluate. So I think statistics are very, very important. Rebounding is a critical factor in terms of are we working hard enough? So I think the statistics right now, everything is broken down into incredible statistical detail. But I think it can be very helpful. And we use those. If a kid's shooting 15% from 3-point line, we're going to say, you know, that's really not where you ought to be shooting from. And we could use those statistics to show kids, okay, you're shooting 15% from 3-point line. She's shooting 38%. Now, who should be taking most of the threes? And sometimes they can understand that. but I think that's what was really beneficial for us. And obviously just knowing team tendencies, knowing what kind of defenses, if there was a unique style of defense that they played, those things have been very important. When I first started coaching Division I, we'd be lucky to get a tape on their opponent. So a lot of times we were flying blind. By the time I finished 30-some years later, you'd watch 6, 8, 9, whatever time you could used to watch teams play, so you knew the personnel you were facing.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. You're talking about just the film and preparation. I mean, you just had to make things up on the fly almost, right? Or word of mouth, maybe you would call somebody else who had played them.
Exactly. You just called friends and said, what did they do? And, you know, I remember back in the day, when Aki Hill was the coach at Oregon State, they had this unique extended 2-3 that they ran. And they were a great tournament team because nobody scouted them. Nobody knew what they were going to do. It was such a unique style of defense. Yet if you were able to watch 5 or 6 tapes, then you had a much better idea. There were weaknesses in that defense like anything else. So that, in those days, though, boy, I remember watching Oregon State play in the Juicy Tournament, which was the big tournament sponsored by Portland State, where they always got a number of top 10 teams to come in, and God, they would struggle with Oregon State because they'd never seen it before. So I think, yeah, it's different now. Nobody has any secrets now. If you have a unique style, it doesn't become unique very long if it's successful. Because somebody else is going to mimic it or figure out a way to deal with it.
Yeah, very true. Very true. All right, we're going to take another break. When we return, Coach Sollers will try to beat the shot clock here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
Coaches, as you prepare for the upcoming season, don't forget to renew your OBCA membership. Membership includes access to exclusive resources from high school coaches across the country, as well as access to Lucio Sports Technology, the same technology used by NBA franchises. Membership starts at just $15. Don't delay. Renew your OBCA membership today.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. We're talking with Jim Sollers, former women's basketball coach at the University of Portland. Coach, for my next set of questions, I'm going to put 35 seconds on a timer, and I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions that should have 1 to 2 word responses, hopefully, and then we're going to see how many questions we can get through in that 35 seconds. Does that sound good?
Good.
All right. Let's do it. I'll hit 35 seconds on the timer. We are starting now. Do you think high school basketball should have a shot clock?
Yes.
If you're up 3 with less than 10 seconds, do you foul?
7 seconds or less, yes.
What's your favorite way to guard on-ball screens?
Two ways. Double it. Or a hedge high.
Do you think the high school 3-point line should be moved back?
No, I think it's fine.
What's your favorite sports movie?
Let's see, Bull Durham.
Bull Durham. And my favorite question, what is one word officials would use to describe you?
Argumentative.
Time. Well done. Well done. I like it. Coach, did you ever use your PhD with the officials? Did you ever say, listen, I have a doctorate. I know that I'm right. Did you ever use that one?
No, that doesn't even work with restaurants, you know? I mean, certainly wouldn't work with referees. No, when I said argumentative, that's not true. I had great friends who were referees and still do, as a matter of fact. But I think they would say I probably shot my mouth off too much.
Yeah, I think you're not the only coach that has done that, for sure. So the shot clock segment, Coach, is just a fun way to ask some quick questions, but also, as I'm sure you're aware, is a big topic of conversation at the high school level in terms of implementing a shot clock, just because it is at the college level. You mentioned you're in favor of the shot clock. Can you elaborate a little bit on why you'd like to see that implemented at the high school level?
Well, I think it just gets the game moving more. I don't think it needs to be a 30-second clock necessarily. I think 35, 40 seconds for high school would be fine. You can still show a lot of patience within that time frame. I don't really like the 24-second. I think teams tend to rush things, it becomes too individual. But I do think if they had a 35, 40-second clock, at least they'd get accustomed to that time frame. They can still milk the clock a little bit, but at the same time, they don't have to rush into things. And I think one of the biggest problems, not so much now because the skill level has improved so much, but when I first started coaching women, even in college, my God, turn the ball over so much just by rushing things, rush shots. And it just was ugly, very frankly. And I think a time clock keeps it moving, but I don't think we want to get into the rush pattern either.
Right. Did you ever notice, or could you tell a difference, maybe a kid, let's say you recruited from the state of Washington that did have a shot clock versus a kid from maybe the state of Oregon where they didn't play with the shot clock? Could you kind of tell the difference?
No, you know, really couldn't. There were kids from Oregon who liked to jack it up. If it felt like leather, they were going to jack it up. And so I don't think that really had too much of an influence on it. I do think the one thing that I think in looking at Oregon and Washington teams, I think Oregon girls teams seem to take care of the basketball better. They're trained to do it, and they just – better job. Don't think they turn it up. Now, I don't have statistical proof of that, but I think they tend to turn the ball over less because they have more time. And that's why I sort of feel that the shot clock would be fine, but not, I don't think the 24 clock is a good idea.
Right. Coach, you've seen a lot of basketball, been in a lot of gyms. I'm curious, do you have a good story of like the strangest thing or scenario you've ever seen in a basketball gym?
Yes, I do. I've had a number of strange things happen on the basketball court, but probably one of the most bizarre, I remember the people involved. We were playing UTEP at home, and Amy Claybo, who's from Glencoe, was a player of the year in Oregon when she was a senior in high school, but she was our center, and somehow UTEP got the tip. And one of their players took off the wrong direction with the ball and was ready to lay it in. And one of my players, totally confused, fouled her as she was shooting the ball at our end. So the foul was called, but it wasn't a shooting foul, of course. It was just a backcourt foul. But everybody's trying to figure out what in the hell is going on, because we're defending. Yeah, it was crazy. The refs did the right thing. They called a backcourt foul. Then they just stopped the game, got the players together, explained that both teams were going in the wrong direction, started over again.
That's a good one. That's a good one, Coach. Yeah, that was. I'm glad the officials handled that correctly. Yeah, that would be a tough one. Oh, man.
Really interesting things happen. One of my favorite stories when I first started coaching women's basketball, I was at Wenatchee Valley College and we were playing Yakima. And one of my players late in the game goes in for a lay-in. And the referees in those days, they'd hired, one was an older lady who was a PE teacher. And she just stood in front of the scorer's table going back and forth. And she had a young kid who was a Yakima Valley Community College student who was officiating the other official, only two officials. He ran the length of court, one end to the other, all the way down. Well, anyway, one of my players goes in late in the game to lay it in, chest gets wiped out. And the ball drops in the middle of the lane, and the woman who was right in front of me at the time blew the whistle out of her mouth. So it made a kind of a funny little tweeting noise. And then she started jumping up and down, waving her arms back and forth. Nobody knew what that meant. One of the opposing players, Yakima player, picked the ball up, raced to the other end of the court, lay it in. She said, "Basket good." And I go ballistic. And she said, "But coach, it was just a partial whistle." Fortunately, everything has improved since then.
Oh, I haven't heard of the partial whistle yet, Coach. That's a
great one. I heard about it.
Yes. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. Oh, goodness. Probably a little different for you at the college level than maybe the high school level, but what was your process for selecting your team captain?
You know, the team voted for one of them, and the coaches selected the other. As I remember, there may have been some exceptions to that, but I think that was normally the process.
Yeah.
And it seemed to work out. We usually had two captains, and I think that was the process we used, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. did you as coaches have maybe veto power? I mean, it's, you want to entrust that to your kids, but probably less so at the college level, I would say. At the high school level, sometimes they pick leaders that aren't the good leaders.
You know, we never had I'm sure we could have. I don't think we ever did. I don't remember that we ever vetoed one of them. And normally a kid that, you know, some of the times if a player was voted just for popularity by our teammates, they didn't take as active or as dominant a role as a captain anyway. So, but I don't remember that ever being a problem, though.
Yeah. Did you give your captains any specific roles or responsibilities?
Well, yeah, as I said, we put a lot of responsibility on our captains and our whole entire upper class. As I said, particularly off the court kinds of things. A lot of times, you know, in college, you don't, kids live in dorms. We can't know what's going on there all the time. And we just put it on our older kids to say, you've got to protect the younger ones because they're going to come in here and they're going to do silly things. I mean, they're kids. I always said 18 to 22 year olds, it's just licensed to be dumb. And I just said, if you think someone is putting themselves in danger, either say through alcohol, drug use, their choice of dates even, you need to let us know or you need to step in. And then if it doesn't change, if you don't feel comfortable telling us right away, you need to come in and talk with us. And as far as I know, only one time did I ever feel that maybe the seniors or the older kids had taken advantage of that position. 90% of the time, or more than that, it was a really good process. It didn't mean the upperclassmen were saints necessarily, but I gave them sort of the protective role over the kids, the younger players.
Yeah, I like that. You talked a little bit about some of the team bonding things that you would do with kids. Did you have a favorite activity, team bonding wise, that you would do with your team?
You know, one of the most fun things that we ever did, we had a talent show every year where each class, say three or four freshmen, three or four sophomores, et cetera, they each would have to present some kind of we'd have a talent show and the coaches would be the would be the judges, and they would demonstrate a talent, whether it be put on a play or sing or dance, and usually it was goofy and didn't show much talent, but it was fun, and we had a great time. They didn't have to be the best basketball players to be the most talented, so it was a way of really getting everyone involved and feeling like they had something to contribute. And we always did a preseason trip to the beach, usually down at Seaside, and we rent a big old house, or rent a house, it usually is a big old house, and we'd cook our own meals. We'd have a practice at the local high school and invite the local high school kids to come in and watch. And play games, you know, team games of one kind or another in the evenings afterwards. We'd just go down on a Saturday and come back on a Sunday. But it was always a fun thing to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. Did you have a favorite drill that you always like to do with your kids?
You know, I think my favorite and maybe most flexible drill, I thought it was so multifaceted that it was really a good drill. It was just basic four-on-four cut throws. Well, we always had 12 players, or we could throw in a couple of our guys that came in to help with practice. And so, and we'd either do it four-on-four cutthroat half court, so one team is standing off, two other teams are playing, and we'd rotate accordingly, or we'd do it full court, where there'd be two teams playing at one end. The other team might have two people under the basket and two filtering on as the defensive team rebounded and then took it across midcourt line. They'd come in. You've seen that drill. We'd do it with four-on-four cutthroat. And, you know, the nice thing about it was we could focus on offensive rebounds. You got so many points for offensive rebounding. If that was what you wanted to emphasize, you could have negative points for turnovers. So we could give extra points for a an efficient, fast break finish. And so we could do a lot of different things with this, as well as work on defense as well. So that I thought was one of the most effective and multifaceted drills that we had.
Yeah.
And the kids, I mean, they were playing.
Right.
And that is always I think appeals to the team and the enthusiasm high in a situation like that.
Yeah. And by putting point values on places of emphasis, right, I think also adds kind of a fun added competitive element. It's already
sure.
competitive.
Yeah, we would do that.
That extra.
We'd either have one person, say, if the team that wasn't playing was down at the other end, we could have one under the basket and three filled. We never did it with one. We'd have two under the basket, and then two kids would filter on, or we could have three under the basket and one additional coming on. So you could adjust it to try to cover the areas that you felt you needed work on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Coach, I think that's all the questions I have for you today. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Derek. I appreciate it. Nice talking to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. Thank you.
And good luck in the season.
Thank you. Yes, appreciate it. Yeah, we're getting started here this next week. So, coaches, if you have any follow-up questions or want to get a hold of Coach Sollers, you can find his contact information in the episode description. The Oregon Basketball Coaches Association wishes you all the best of luck with your upcoming season. We won't have any new episodes until the end of our current basketball season. But until then, you can find all episodes on our website, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We hope you'll join us next time on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Until then, coach them up.
Thank you for listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Is there a coach you'd like to hear from or a topic you'd like to hear us discuss? You can write us a message on the Anchor website or send us an email at OregonBasketballCoaches@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify.